Developers behind a makeover of Hyde Park Square got some high-profile support this week. Local NIOSH workers got pink slips, and an Ohio mother and son got sentenced in the death of their neighbor who was attacked and killed by their two dogs. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about all of that and more on our weekly news review today, including how to stay safe in the severe weather we've been having in the area. Joining me now to get us started are WVXU long-form reporter Nick Swartzell and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Welcome back, Nick and Chris.
Great to be here, Lucy.
Hey, Lucy.
Hey, Nick, I want to start with you. We just learned yesterday that some international students at the University of Cincinnati are having their student visas revoked. What do we know about what's happening with these students?
Yeah, so this came out yesterday, and I believe in an email from the president's office and also on UC's website. We don't know a whole lot yet. We know it's a few students, according to the University of Cincinnati. We know it's based on their F1 visas or their student visas. And beyond that, not a lot has been kind of revealed about who these folks are or, you know, why these visas have been revoked.
Okay. What is UC President Neville Pinto saying about all this?
He says that the university has been in contact with the folks who have had their visas revoked, and the university is trying to support them however they can. They're holding meetings and listening sessions, trying to, you know, give as much information as they can and also share updates as they get them.
Well, and NPR has reported this is happening in other parts of the country, too. It's not just here in Cincinnati.
That is true. One thing to kind of keep in mind, though, is that we don't know why these visas got revoked. A lot of times when people hear about this happening, they tie it to some specific political views that have been expressed or something like that. And we don't know for sure what exactly is the reasoning behind the revoked of these visas.
Okay. Important to keep in mind. Also this week, a UC student was arrested after a protest. Nick, what happened?
Yeah, so this happened on campus in the afternoon. And we know that there were kind of two different groups. One was fundraising. They're a sort of pro-Palestinian student group. The other is a group of religiously affiliated protesters, or demonstrators, I guess would be the right word. And they were on campus with signs that I think a lot of people would find objectionable. I don't think I'm editorializing there too much. Just some pretty, you know, things that are not in the mainstream, let's say that. And the two groups had an exchange. Accounts diverge about what exactly happened, but one student had a Palestinian flag and was waving it close to the preachers. University of Cincinnati police say that he actually kind of like made contact with the protester or
physical
the preachers. Yeah, and didn't back away from them when UC police told him to. The police have kind of said that he was disorderly conduct. He was resisting arrest. Other students there who are part of the student group say that's not the case. So there's a little bit of a disagreement about how this all unfolded.
So UC police say the student was arrested because of disorderly conduct and resisting arrest and that sort of thing. What do the students say about what happened?
The students are claiming that they think the main offense was that he was waving this Palestinian flag. But they both agree that there was some engagement between the two groups. So I think it's really just a matter of, did he make contact with one of these preachers? You know, did police tell him to get away and he didn't do it? That kind of thing.
I see. What more can you tell us about these preachers that were demonstrating on UC's campus? Is this a group that is there often or has been there in the past?
Yeah, these are folks who show up from time to time on campus. Some students there have said that it's a weekly thing lately. I know, kind of riding my bike through campus to cut through to go places, I've seen them before. They do seem to be there to kind of, share some pretty outlandish views, I would say, or you know, one could call them provocative for sure. Mm-hmm. They're pretty regular visitors on campus.
Could UC keep these preachers off the campus if the university wanted to?
No, this is, you know, we're talking about a public university. This is public ground. The First Amendment rights apply here. UC has said that, you know, like this, we're not allowed to tell them no. they can issue them kind of barriers if they request them, which is what happened the day of this protest. But they're not really allowed to police them based on kind of what they're saying.
Well, you talked about how accounts diverge about why this student was arrested. What do you know about how long he was held?
So he was taken to the Hamilton County Justice Center. There was a protest. I counted more than 100 people at the protest outside. Most of those were students, part of the student group. He was held for a couple hours. He was released on bond, within 2 hours of that protest. He subsequently pleaded not guilty.
Okay. Have there been any other statements about his arrest?
So the Council on American Islamic Relations of Ohio released a statement condemning his arrest, saying it was uncalled for and that it's, you know, related to his stance on Palestine.
Well, let's talk about a different piece of news this week that's related to the administration. Federal job cuts came to the Cincinnati office of the National Institutes of Occupational Safety and Health, known commonly as NIOSH. That happened this week. Chris, tell us what happened and how many workers are involved in all this.
Well, we know that at least 165 of the union representative workers at NIOSH's site have been, you know, basically dismissed as a part of the cuts at the Department of Health and Human Services. The NIOSH union representative also told me that she believed, you know, didn't have it confirmed, but believed that most of the supervisory employees also were put on administrative leave, kind of as a precursor to them also being discharged.
Nick, how did the employees find out this was happening?
From union representatives and employees that I talked to, it was an email that showed up in their inbox early the morning that they were dismissed. So they got to work, checked their email, and found out they were going to get, you know, terminated at some point in the future.
Huh. Nick, what kind of presence does NIOSH have in Cincinnati? How many employees does the agency have overall?
So NIOSH has two facilities here in Cincinnati, sizable facilities. Each one has roughly 200 people in it. There are about a little over 400 people total that work in Cincinnati's NIOSH offices. And they do a lot of different things related to occupational safety and health.
Let's talk about some of those, Nick. What kinds of work do people at NIOSH do?
So there are sort of research projects they do in terms of workplace safety. They follow up on sort of requests for investigations into safety in particular workplaces. They issue recommendations for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. They also do some research in terms of workplace illness. So, you know, when COVID was happening, how do we keep people from transmitting COVID to each other while they're working? They have epidemiologists who do that kind of work, too. And there's a lot of other things as well.
Chris, you talked to a union representative who also works at NIOSH. What kind of work did that person tell you they do?
She did mostly work related to firefighters. So she's on what she called in my interview is the firefighter health team. She said she researched their exposure in the workplace, which obviously considerable if
right.
They're putting out things that are burning. But her quote was interesting. She said, "You name an industry and NIOSH does research on it to make those workers safe and healthy on the job."
Hmm. Well, Chris, how has the federal government explained these cuts?
Yeah, that's really kind of interesting. It's a part of they're cutting about 20,000 employees overall. So our folks are part of those, that number. And basically what they're explaining, you know, what the federal government is saying that it's doing is it's consolidating a bunch of these agencies and DHHS. And, you know, they're trying to, you know, the things that they said are, you know, we're trying to improve coordination of health resources for low-income Americans. It's unclear to me, though, whether the NIOSH mission as it exists today, as it you know, exists in terms of researching ways to prevent workplace injury, whether that will continue at all in the federal government, because that is obviously different than health resources for low-income Americans.
Sure. Well, and NIOSH wasn't the only location to face cuts, was it, Nick?
No, there are some other facilities across the country. Obviously, I know Pittsburgh lost about 200 people in other locations as well.
Chris, you were just talking about that union leader you interviewed. What was her reaction? I mean, clearly she feels like this work is very important.
Yeah, I mean, she viewed it as a strike against working Americans, drawback to them, because hundreds of millions of workers in this country, and this is an agency that she views in her mission as to keeping them safe, basically. Mm-hmm.
Nick, what did you hear from the NIOSH employees you interviewed?
Mostly what I heard is a focus on kind of the implications of this for workers as well. I think similar to what Chris is saying, I talked to an epidemiologist who received one of these notices that she will be, terminated at some point. And she said, I'm really worried about what will happen to workers in the future. If we don't have these areas of research where we're trying to figure out how to keep workers safe, what's going to happen to them?
Chris, I know Congressman Greg Landsmond issued a statement about these cuts. What did he have to say about it?
He basically said this is more chaos. This is a word he uses frequently when it comes to the Trump administration. His message is that, they are not keeping their campaign promises to lower prices and that they are just sowing chaos throughout the country as a result of the policies that they're pursuing.
And Chris, is there anything union leaders can do in response to these cuts?
I was told they are exploring their, legal options. Of course, we've seen, without going too much into detail, but we've seen some of these types of moves stopped by the courts or ordered to be stopped because, as the union worker I talked, the union representative I talked to said, these are congressionally mandated functions. Congress has the power of the purse. The president can't just cancel spending by Congress, although the president disputes that. But that question has not been settled by the courts yet.
Chris, Nick mentioned earlier that there are two NIOSH offices in Greater Cincinnati right now, and there was a plan to consolidate those
right
into one site. Talk about that and where that stands in all this.
Well, and I've been reporting on that for a few months now. We did a cover story about the state of Uptown Cincinnati. So NIOSH plans to consolidate, or it did plan to consolidate its facilities in the northwest corner of Martin Luther King Jr. Drive and Redding Road. The federal government long has had a plan, and former Senator Sherrod Brown was a champion of this, to build kind of a consolidated facility as a part of the Innovation Corridor up there. They have not exercised their purchase option on that land. It kind of is ongoing. And so I asked the union rep that I talked to about that, and her response was interesting. She said, well, if we have no workers, basically, I'm paraphrasing her, the end point was, why would we build a facility? Mm-hmm. So, and that goes along with doubt among the elected officials and civic leaders who are focused on Uptown about that facility actually ever being built.
Hmm. Well, and the federal government's looking to sell so many of its properties, too. So that's, I guess, another factor in there.
It doesn't make sense that they would build another one when they're trying to sell everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or many things.
Yeah. Well, Chris, I want to circle back to something I mentioned at the top of the show, and that is Hyde Park Square. We talked earlier this week on the program about this big development proposed for Hyde Park Square that many neighbors oppose, but you broke some news about it this week.
Yeah, I was at an event at UC earlier this week, and the mayor Aftab Pureval kind of indicated that he was in support of it, which is kind of the first time that we had heard about that. So I went and interviewed him in his office the next day, and he kind of came out and gave his full-throated support for this development, which, as everybody may or may not know, it's a $150 million mixed-use project. It would have a hotel. It would have 125 new apartments, and it would reestablish the retail that we kind of see on the first floor around Hyde Park Square as well.
Well, and I mentioned that lots of neighbors and local nearby businesses are opposed. Can you briefly sum up why? I mean, we talked about that earlier this week, but
sure,
in case people missed that conversation.
Their main objection is to the height of the buildings that are going to be constructed. The buildings are about 85 feet tall. The closest building to the development, which is called the Elace Building, is depending on where you are standing, it's 60, 65 feet roughly. So the new buildings are 20 feet higher, although the top stories are stepped back. They're terraced. So if you're standing directly under the building, you would not see that it is as tall as it is. Now, if you go back, if you're down the street or something, yes, you would see that it's a pretty big building. So that the height is the main objection. There are also parking concerns, and they're more like traffic concerns from the potential new people coming in and going to the apartments or the hotel or using the retail. So those are kind of the main concerns.
Why does the mayor say he supports this plan?
You know, the mayor views it as a part of the housing problem that the city has. This adds brand new apartments in Hyde Park Square, and the city is well short of the units that it needs, although I know that we've had disputes over the years over how many we need. Clearly, everyone kind of agrees there's probably thousands of units that we are short. And so he views this as a way to start, you know, to deal with that as one element of dealing with it.
What does he say, though, about the opposition to this plan? Because other neighborhood groups seem to be worried about whether city officials are listening to Hyde Park residents and businesses and what it could mean for other neighborhoods.
He understands the concerns. He, you know, if you go into them, I mean, the city has done or has looked at the parking study that the developer has put forth. You know, it was kind of dismissed as, you know, we're not going to have a major traffic concern there any more than we already do. It's a busy part of town. That's not going to change. It's not going to become cul-de-sacs and suburban environment. It is what it is. And so, but as far as the height concern, he understands it. He really did focus when I interviewed him on the setbacks, the terraces at the top of the building. He buys into the notion that really, if you're walking down the street, you're not gonna notice it above you the way that the neighbors have kind of made a centerpiece of their opposition.
Hmm. What's next for this? What are the next votes? How does this keep moving?
Yeah, this goes to a city council committee focused on housing, where we see a lot of the stuff that comes out of the planning commission, which this has already been voted through, go into. That, I believe, is what I've been told. It's going to be April 22nd. These things can change, but that's the plan right now. And once it goes through committee, it could be a council that very week.
Hmm. Well, we've heard from the mayor now, thanks to you. I know the vice mayor, Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney, was the lone person on the planning commission to vote against this recommendation. Have we heard from any other council members about what they think?
I am in the process of doing that, Lucy,
okay.
I don't have any handicap on how the vote will go at this point. No one has said. Not no one, but you know the votes. You know they'll be cast when they're cast, and I don't know how it will go quite yet. So.
Okay, keeping their cards a little close to the vest, and there need to be 5 votes for this to pass.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yeah, the Planning Commission recommended approval, so that means that council can approve this with a simple majority vote.
Okay, so. Either way, if council votes yes or no, there are more steps before this could move forward, right?
Absolutely. So this is a planned development, right? And the reason, you know, it's one of the reasons this is so controversial is because basically they're overriding or upzoning the amount of and what can be built here. The hotel is not allowable use. So planned development, when you have that instead of the existing zoning, you can build a hotel. You can ask the city, okay, we want to deviate from the plan, from the zoning, and build a hotel. And so this is also located in an urban design overlay district. And what that means is it has to meet certain design standards, right? And to really shortcut it, it has to look pretty. It has to fit in with the rest of Hyde Park Square. And so it will have to go to planning commission for that, as well as a final development plan. I would say there are at least 2 or 3 other times that it's going to have to go to planning commission before anybody can, you know, dig up anything, throw a shovel, throw a hammer, whatever.
Sure. And we've heard from the lawyer representing the neighborhood council that if council does vote in favor, there could be litigation, right?
Very much so. The lawyers for the neighborhood association have said that this is what has been done before at the planning commission was the improper procedure. They argued it should have basically gone through a different procedure. And so they have floated the idea that they will go to court as a result of this.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with WVXU long-form reporter Nick Swartzel and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me,
Lucy.
Up next, could an investigation into dog attacks in Ohio lead to a tougher state law? This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A Pickaway County judge this week sentenced a mother and son to prison after their dogs killed their 73-year-old neighbor. Joining me now to talk about this case and her investigation into the many dog attacks that happen in Ohio each year is Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Laura Bischoff. Welcome back, Laura.
Hello, hello.
Hey, so we had you on the program to talk about your investigation into dog attacks in Ohio a couple weeks ago. Tell us more about the sentence that was handed down this week.
So this mother and son, Adam and Susan Withers, they lived in a condo next door to Joanne and Stanley Eichelbarger. And in October of last year, the two pit bulls owned by the Withers escaped the condo and attacked Joanne as she was gardening in a little plot between the two condos. And she died a very violent and gruesome death. And then the Withers went to trial in February before Pickaway County Common Pleas Court Judge Matthew Chafin. They were both convicted after the jury deliberated for a few hours. And the sentencing was this past Wednesday in Pickaway County, and Judge Chafin gave them the maximum. They will serve at least 14 years in prison. They could serve as long as 19 and a half years. He stacked their sentences so that they got 11 to 14 years on involuntary manslaughter, 18 months on one of the dog law violation counts, and 18 months on one of the other dog mauling count or dog confinement counts. And this, I think, is probably the longest criminal sentence for a dog attack, a fatal dog attack in state history.
Well, I was going to ask you if this kind of sentence is unusual. I mean, what typically happens in cases like this? Because sadly, there have been other cases like this.
Well, you know, one of the problems with Ohio's dog law in the eyes of the victims and even some of the dog wardens is that there's not felony. It's really hard to get to a felony charge, even in cases where there's like severe disfigurement or maiming of the victim. And even if there's evidence of aggressive behavior already previously documented in prior attacks. In this case, because there was a prior attack that resulted in a woman named Kimberly Black getting a few fractures and a bunch of stitches, and then her puppy had to be euthanized because it was attacked by one of the Withers dogs. That kind of like set the groundwork and the documentation that these dogs were aggressive, and that the Withers had a duty to confine them in locked enclosures, walk them on a muzzle, keep them on short chain leashes, et cetera. But they failed to do that. They failed to follow those safety safeguards. And the dogs were able to get out of the condo when they were not home, when the mother and son were not home. And, you know, one of the things was that the police testified that they didn't, their deadbolt, the latch on their front door was busted. There was like a towel that was jammed in the space where the deadbolt should have been. And the judge said, you know, this was a $15 go to the hardware store fix your front door so that your dogs can't escape, particularly since you had these menacing, aggressive, mean dogs. The judge also dinged the Withers for like a lack of remorse. Susan Withers cried, I think, three times during the trial, twice when she watched body camera footage of her dogs getting shot, and once when they were talking about a third dog that was not involved in the attacks that was impounded. But, you know, when they were describing the horrible death that Joanne suffered, there was no emotion, no remorse whatsoever. I do think that this is probably going to go to appeal, and it has to do with how the counts were merged. I'm not an attorney, and I don't typically cover things in court, but the Pickaway County prosecutor, Jamie Fountain, said that it's most certainly going to get appealed.
You know, last time we talked, you talked about how under Ohio law now, a dog can kill someone, and the law doesn't require that dog to be killed if it's the first person they've killed. Is that that? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, you know, one of the state legislators that tried to change that law, he calls it the two free kills. That's correct. So, a dog can go kill someone. And then just be labeled a vicious dog, and the owner has to buy liability insurance and, you know, keep it locked up, et cetera. And then not until that vicious dog escapes a second time and kills a second person would the court be required to order euthanasia. You know, I haven't found any examples of judges actually allowing that to happen, but that is what is permitted under current law. State Representative Kevin Miller, he's the former state trooper, a Republican in the Ohio House. He says that's garbage, and he wants to change that law, maybe give the dog wardens some more tools to do their jobs. He is hesitant, though, to increase criminal penalties for dog owners when their dogs are responsible for very serious injuries. Going to a felony was something that had been proposed in the past, but it didn't clear the legislature. So he's busy crafting something that he thinks has a chance of passing out of the General Assembly.
I think you referenced it earlier when you were talking about the sentencing, but I want to make sure it's clear what happened to these two dogs that killed this neighbor. Were they killed by police, did you say?
Well, yeah. So the Asheville Village police officer, Jester, he showed up on scene and the dog started to charge him. He shot Apollo, one of the dogs, and then that one went tearing off down the street. And then the second dog, Echo, was standing over Joanne's body, and he opted to put the dog down there. Echo ran back into the condo, and the police didn't go get the dog until later that night after the Withers came home. It was a whole thing. And then Apollo was like out running around the neighborhood and attacked a woman named Courtney Jo Johnson. She was out walking her two dogs, and she opted to let Apollo went after her dogs. She dropped her leashes and ran to safety, and one of her dogs was killed by Apollo. So later that afternoon, Apollo was out running in the field, and the cops are trying to find this dog and take care of it. They shot the dog. They shot at the dog. Eventually, a sheriff's deputy ran it over with an SUV, and then they put it out of put the dog out of its misery.
Oh, you. Also mentioned this lady who was killed, her husband. I mean, these two dogs killed this woman while her husband witnessed it from a screened-in porch. What did her family have to say during the sentencing?
Well, first off, her husband, Stanley, he declined very rapidly after this attack. He had Parkinson's disease and Lewy body dementia. So he went into a nursing home, and he passed away I think 2 or 3 weeks ago. The family says that Stanley's death is entirely attributable to this attack, to the loss of his wife, his caregiver, his home. They just don't think that he would have declined as rapidly had his wife still been at his side. The two kids, adult kids, Bill Rogers and Erlene Romine, made victim impact statements, and they said, this is forever altering their family and the gatherings that they have, and they really believe that Joanne had many, many years of healthy life ahead of her. She was 73 years old, but she didn't take any medications. She was active, volunteered in the community, was really into her grandkids. And they said that Bill Rogers made a really powerful statement at the sentencing, and he just said, there is no hole dark enough and deep enough and no hell hot enough. And there's no penalty harsh enough to be meted out here against the people who are responsible for his mother's death.
Last time we talked about this, we got a lot of calls and emails in defense of pit bulls. Can you clarify what Ohio law says or doesn't say about specific dog breeds or classifications? Because pit bull's not a breed. A lot of people call a lot of different kinds of dogs pit bulls. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, pit bulls are more like a type. It's more like a look and a structure of the dog rather than an actual breed. So in 2012, Ohio redid its dog laws and got rid of breed-specific language, which, you know, characterized certain breeds as dangerous, as automatically dangerous, and, you know, reworked the law to move away from breed-specific. Now the law focuses on the deed of the animal, not the breed. So it's more like the actions of the animal characterizes whether or not it's a vicious or dangerous dog.
Mm-hmm. Not labeling an animal just because of, you know, what
it looks like. Right. Yeah. And also, like, there is no, I haven't heard any whispers of going back to breed specific legislation in Ohio. I think that they want to tighten up the laws, but it's, again, it's not going to be targeting pit bulls specifically.
Gotcha. Well, it sounds like based on your investigation and the response it's gotten, some high-profile people really do want to see this law change. What have you heard about that?
Well, right now, things are kind of in a bottleneck at the State House because the lawmakers are trying to get this two-year state budget passed. That's supposed to get a floor vote in the House on Wednesday, so that might ease up a few things after that. Kevin Miller said he's still working with the Legislative Service Commission, which is the nonpartisan state agency that writes the bills for lawmakers. And so I would think that he's probably going to introduce something in the weeks after the budget clears the House.
But you heard from the governor. The governor would like to see a change, right? And didn't Attorney General Dave Yost say he'd like to see a change?
Yes, both of them think that two free kill provision in the law is something that should be revised. The governor didn't offer any specifics, but he said that, you know, Ohio needs to take this more seriously and do better.
Hmm. You mentioned State Representative Miller, this legislation he's working on. Are there any more details about that legislation that you can share with us?
No, again, he hasn't, they haven't introduced it yet. I know that he's working with the Ohio Association of County Dog Wardens to try to, you know, make sure that the dog wardens get what they need. One of the things in Ohio is that every county has a dog warden, but it really varies how much they're paid or how they're trained. Some of them operate under the sheriff's office. Some of them operate under the county board of commissioners. In some counties, it might be a part-time dog warden. And in others, it's a full, like a law enforcement agency. And so there's a lot of variety of, you know, how equipped and how trained your dog warden is going to be just based on your zip code and where you live.
What do the dog wardens want to see with this? I mean, are you hearing kind of a unified voice from dog wardens about what they'd like to see in terms of changes?
I think they have, well, I mean, they all have different ideas, but I think that the Dog Warden Association would like to see better training and maybe some basic standards for what dog wardens should know how to do and what kind of information they have to have. I think that they want to see some stronger criminal penalties in, you know, very serious injury cases, and the ability to order euthanasia after the first very serious injury. You know, one of the people we featured in this project is Avery Russell, and she's now 12 years old. She's from Columbus. She was attacked by two pit bulls when she was out on a play date back in June. And, you know, she lost both ears. She had a lot of disfigurement of her face. And one of the dogs was put down by a police officer responding on scene, and then the other dog was impounded, and the owner still wants to have that dog returned to her.
And is a judge going to decide whether that's the case, or does the dog warden decide? Who decides if that dog gets returned to the owner?
Well, so the owner, Stephanie Ayers, she has pled not guilty to misdemeanor charges in Franklin County Municipal Court over failure to confine her dogs and failure to register them. So they are still adjudicating that case. It's supposed to, there was going to be a trial next week, but I checked yesterday and it looks like it's like going to be a hearing on a motion. And so the trial hasn't even happened yet. She has pled not guilty. And again, wants her dog back.
Well, thank you for following up with us on this. I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer reporter, Laura Bischoff. Thank you so much for your time today, Laura.
Thank you, Lucy.
Up next, we'll get tips for how to interpret outdoor weather sirens and how to stay safe during severe storms. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We count on WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner for her expertise in many things large, like the Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks, and small, like the Spotted Salamander. Today, we have her here to share her expertise in something large and loud, our local weather sirens. Tana, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lucy. I wasn't quite expecting such a fun introduction.
Oh, well, there you go.
That's so
kind. Yeah, well, thank you. So we had some severe weather roll through the region earlier this week. Thousands of people lost power. Uprooted trees fell on cars and houses across roadways. We asked you here because you are our resident weather siren expert, and we want to do some weather siren myth busting.
I'm all for it. Let's do it, Lucy.
Okay. First, I have to tell you, I was in my house on Sunday. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear any sirens. Okay. And that leads me to your most hated weather siren myth. Tell us about it.
Yeah. Well, you probably didn't hear the weather sirens inside your home because they are not meant to be heard indoors. The outdoor weather sirens are meant to be heard outdoors. So
you say that like it should be understood in the name, Tana.
I know, but I guess we've just all had them in our lives for so long and we know what they mean. And so I guess you're sort of maybe ingrained to think that you should, but no. I talked with Nick Crossley this week. He's the director of the emergency system, the EMA, or Emergency Management Agency, and Homeland Security. He's got this big, long title. Sorry. and, you know, he said it wouldn't be really feasible, right? Houses are dense things, or buildings are dense things, and sound is not going to penetrate through those to everyone countywide. The system was only ever intended to alert people who are outdoors that wouldn't have things like a weather radio or some sort of source indoors to alert them.
Okay. So some people maybe can hear them inside if
yes.
they're near a siren, depending on how old their house is, what kind of insulation they have, windows, all that kind of stuff.
Precisely.
But that isn't the point of that.
Correct.
Okay. So what's the best way to be alerted to severe weather when you are inside?
Right. Well, you know, the best sort of thing to have around would be some kind of NOAA radio, a weather radio. These are the things that send out that annoying screeching alarm at, you know, 2 a.m. to make sure that you have been notified. This is going to be triggered by the National Weather Service. You know, it's in your area. It works on antenna. They can be on battery backups. There's some that can plug in, but you know, a battery backup is a good plan in case the power goes out. Like you said, this week it did for a lot of people. So look for one of that has specific area messaging and coding. I think it all has it. That's what triggers the National Weather Service sends it out, and we can't hear it, but it triggers radios to do those things. Another good thing to have would be an app on your phone from whatever your favorite local TV weather station is, or various weather apps. A lot of them, if not all of them, have some kind of alert on it. I wake up every morning and I see like 7 messages about various weather things. And then check your local TV stations, really, because, you know, the folks that have meteorologists on, we say local media, but really the TV stations that have local meteorologists, you want to follow them as well. They're on their websites. They're on social media. If you have a TV, you can just turn it right on.
As long as the power's
on. As yep. long as you have power. Yes.
Yeah.
And okay. then I guess along those lines too, Crossley said, you know, people have to just pay attention. And I kind of thought that was good. And I also thought it was a little obvious until Wednesday night when I was playing soccer and I said to a friend, okay, well, I'm going to go home before the storms. And she said, what storms? And I looked at her and I thought she was messing with me. And I said, are you serious? And she said, yes, I've been working all day. And I said, oh, well, there's severe weather coming and it's going to be here in 2 hours. So we should all go home.
Yes, we take for granted that in the news business, we know what news is happening much of the time. Okay, so what are your handy tips for remembering the difference between a tornado watch and a tornado warning? Because those things flash on the TV screen from time to time. How do you keep in mind what's what?
Right, and watch and warning, this is going to be the same for like severe thunderstorms or anything that's watch and warning, basically. Watch means watch out, a tornado could happen, so be prepared. A warning means, warning, a tornado is occurring, seek shelter. Now, if you're like, I could easily flip those up, the taco method, which I didn't include in my story this week, but this is pretty
taco method.
Yeah, maybe it'll make it a little easier, right? Because who doesn't love tacos?
Right.
So under the taco method, a taco watch means get ready. All the ingredients for tacos are on the table. A taco warning means get to your seat. Tacos have arrived. Okay. It's time to eat.
Okay.
So watch out. Things could happen. Tacos are being prepared. Warning, tacos are ready. It's time to get to the table / wherever your safe place is.
I love that method. I thought something was going to spell out the word taco. No. And I am so excited. It's about eating tacos and being prepared to eat tacos.
Yes.
That's how I'm going to remember. Okay. Let's get to your second most hated weather siren myth. I appreciate how you ranked these in the piece that you wrote for WVXU.org, our website. Tell us about that one.
So this is the one, and I'm not entirely sure where this myth comes from, but it seems like whenever severe weather happens and the sirens go off, you go on social media and you look around and there's always one or two people that are going, well, the sirens went off a second time. That was the all clear. There is no all clear siren, certainly nowhere in our listening area. If you hear the sirens in our listening area, so Northern Kentucky, Southeast Indiana, Southwest Ohio, it means you need to seek shelter. It means a tornado warning or a tornado has been sighted. I'll put a little asterisk on that. If you are hearing it on a perfectly nice day and it's not noon on a Wednesday, it could be something like a chemical release or something like that. But again, if it's bad weather and you hear the tornado sirens because you're outside, not inside, it means that you need to seek shelter immediately.
And even a chemical release, they're saying get inside.
Yes,
like they
correct.
Don't want you to be outside.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the sirens aren't, hey, we just buzzed it again. Come on out and play and water your plants. It's like...
Precisely.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of maybe hard to think about because now everyone has, you know, that little computer in their pocket. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we can get the same alerts outside that we would get inside. But obviously, the emergency alert system went into effect in the 1970s when that wasn't the case.
Yes. Yes. I long for those days sometimes. but that's a whole different discussion. Okay. The other thing you included in your story on our website, WVXU.org, mm-hmm. is that you can sign up for alerts from your county. And there are different ways to sign up for each county. Is that right?
Right. Now, not every county has their own unique thing. Own unique notification system. So I tried to find them if they did have them. So for example, Hamilton County has Alert HC, which it's based on the Smart 911 system. Several counties use the Smart 911 system. And you can sign up to get all kinds of notifications about hazardous weather, you know, maybe blizzards or flooding, anything like that, chemical releases, they mm-hmm. can be used for that. So that's the big one in Hamilton County would be Alert HC.
Okay. Okay, mm-hmm. so go to our website, WVXU.org, look for Tana's story, and you can figure out if your county's listed and if you can sign up for those alerts.
Yeah.
So in a perfect world, mm-hmm. you won't be outside to hear a weather siren alerting you to severe weather because you'll be inside and safe. But what do you do if you are outside and you're not, like, what should you do? What should your first thing you do be when you hear that severe weather?
Yeah, if you're outside and you hear the sirens, you should seek shelter immediately indoors. Move to the closest substantial shelter that you can find. Protect yourself from flying debris. Now, another, I should make this my third most hated myth.
Okay.
Lucy. We're breaking news here. I have a new hated myth.
More hate from Tana.
More
here
hate.
We go. Okay.
Some people think, oh, well, I should get under a bridge or an overpass if I'm outside and hide under there because I'll be protected. This is also a terrible plan. Do not do this. You want to be somewhere low and flat, like a ditch or a culvert or a depression in the ground. If that's not possible, you're in your car. So stay in your car if that's your decision. If there's nowhere, you know, safer outside in a culvert or whatever, keep your seatbelt on and cover your head and put it below. I'm trying to duck under the microphone. You put your head below the level of the window. Cover it with like a blanket or your hands so that you're below it. Now, the reason you don't want to go up under a bridge or an overpass is because you've got really fast winds from a tornado, and then they get under there and you're just going to get pummeled by all of the debris that's being blown around in the air. And it's going to create like a little wind tunnel effect. So the speeds might be even faster up under the bridge, than the wind speeds up under the bridge than they are certainly closer to the ground.
So that's even more dangerous.
Yeah, it's bad news bears. Don't do it.
Not a good plan. Not a good plan. Okay, well, that's a
bridge is bad.
That's a that's a good one to have number three on your hate list. That's good. Well, and this is really important information. Obviously, we're kind of having fun with it, but it's very important. And severe weather isn't just a problem for this time of year, right?
Right. And, you know, Nick Crossley pointed that out again, the EMA director. We have bad weather now kind of year round. So you don't want to just have your weather, your NOAA weather radio at this time of year and you dig it out. You really want to have these apps and notifications and be, you know, be signed up for Alert HC or whatever it is in your county so that you can be notified any time of the year. And then especially with climate change, we should expect more severe weather.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, and just very quickly, again, this was very serious. There was a tornado that touched down in our neck of the woods, right?
This recently,
yes. Yeah.
I think they've confirmed at least two. I'm not entirely sure about the extent of them or what levels they were at. But this is also the 51st anniversary of those devastating tornadoes in Xenia 51 years ago that killed 32 people.
So important stuff. Sign up for those alerts. Listen, hate the same things Tana hates. Be like Tana. I've been talking with WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner. Thank you so much for your time today, Tana.
My pleasure, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts, or you can listen to the audio online at WVXU.org. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.